Welcome, everyone. This is session number 375. It begins with a family, a conversation with Dr. Caitlin Ryan about families and homosexuality. I'd like to remind all of you to silence your cell phones so none of the rest of us will hear them. And I would like to tell you that I think this is going to be an exciting session. I'm Ron Scow, chairing this session. And we have both Dr. Caitlin Ryan and Bob Reese, our own Sunstone participant who's known well to all of us. Let me just say just a little bit about Dr. Ryan. Caitlin Ryan has worked in the area of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender issues for 35 years now. She started in Atlanta with the first center for AIDS in Atlanta, and she worked with the CDC at that time, and since then her work has been recognized by many community and professional groups, including the American Psychological Association and the National Association of Social Workers. She has been invited to present on her work to the American Medical Association, federal and state agencies, and governments in other countries. I felt exceedingly fortunate just a little over a year ago to meet Caitlin in New York City and to learn about her amazing research and her work in the at San Francisco State University, where she's part of this acceptance project. And since then, she expressed the desire at that time to interact more with the Mormon Church, because she said she's Catholic and she's Mormon, and she thought, and the Mormon Church is, along with her church, one of the most important churches, she feels, to tell about her work. So, beginning then, Bob Reese and others of us began working toward this kind of event that we're experiencing now this week with Caitlin. She made a wonderful presentation in a session on Wednesday, and some of you were there, and now she'll give you the brief version of that session. So I'm going to turn this over to Bob at this point. Bob has his own credentials in the area of Book of Mormon, in the area of many diverse subjects and interests, but he's been a wonderful voice and advocate for gay and lesbian members of the church for many years now. Bob?
Thank you, Ron. It begins with a family. A truism that every Latter-day Saint knows by heart is President David O. McKay's dictum: no other success can compensate for failure in the home. President McKay elaborated, parenthood should be held as a sacred obligation. There is something in the depths of the human soul which revolts against neglectful parenthood. God has implanted deep in the souls of parents the truth that they cannot, with impunity, shirk the responsibility to protect children and youth. I believe that President McKay's expression could be expanded to say, no other success can compensate for failure in the home or in the church. And further, no other success with our heterosexual children can compensate for failure with our homosexual children. And yet it seems to me that we've been all too willing to accept failure both in the home and in the church when it comes to our homosexual members. As families, as congregations, and as a church, we often fail to protect and fail to nurture our gay, lesbian, and transgender children and young people. and the cost to all of us is very great. If there was a plague among us that wounded or killed so many of our young people, that caused families to cast them out and drive them away, that exponentially increased their chances of developing serious psychiatric disorders, of becoming addicted to drugs and alcohol, that made them vulnerable to HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases, and that led many to attempt to or to take their own lives, we would consider it a cultural disaster. And that is exactly what we have. A familial and cultural plague fed by ignorance and misinformation about homosexuality and deep-seated prejudice about homosexuals. It is no exaggeration to say that as a people, we have failed these brothers and sisters. As someone who has counseled and worked with gay and lesbian Latter-day Saints over the past 25 years, I know something of the heartache and the heartbreak that attends this issue. I know parents who have rejected their children and ecclesiastical leaders who have excluded them from worship. I have had gay friends die of AIDS and others who have taken their own lives. I have known many Latter-day Saint families who feel like foreigners in their own extended families and strangers in their own church because they have gay children. And I know many Latter-day Saints whose hearts are not open to including these gay saints in fellowship. Where there is no vision, the people perish generation after generation after generation. For a number of years, some among us have been calling for a new vision in regard to homosexuality. Not a new standard of morality, a new vision. A new vision based not only on scientific discovery, but on the most fundamental principles of the Christian gospel. Ultimately, I believe that scientific discovery and religious principles, to say nothing of common wisdom, converge, even though it may take time. For decades, contrary to common consensus, we have been told that homosexuality, apparently as opposed to heterosexuality, is a chosen and a changeable human condition. Recently, the American Psychological Association issued a resolution stating that mental health professionals should not tell gays they can become straight through therapy or other treatments. Further, the association issued its most comprehensive repudiation of reparative therapy, a concept espoused by a small but persistent group of therapists, often allied with religious conservatives, who maintain that gays can change. No solid scientific evidence exists that such change is likely, says the resolution adopted by a vote of 125-4. The APA said, some research suggests that efforts to produce change could be harmful, inducing depression and suicidal tendencies, of which it seems to me there is incontrovertible evidence among us. As a case in point, last week I received an email from a friend who told me of an LDS man, a returned missionary, successful businessman, husband and father of three, graduate of BYU, who had been in deep turmoil over his homosexual feelings for more than 10 years. His own father, who holds a high church position, was very hateful to this son, telling him over and over how ashamed and how disgusted he was by his son's homosexuality. Unable to live any longer with the conflict, self-loathing, and anguish, this man took his life. Latter-day Saints hold that we are committed to the truth, no matter what the source. B.H. Roberts said, whatever position other churches and their religious teachers may take, the Church of Jesus Christ in the New Dispensation can do no other than to stand for mental activity and earnest effort to come to a knowledge of the truth. I would add, even when that truth is difficult to face, even when it challenges our most deep-seated axioms. All of this is a prelude to introducing Dr. Caitlin Ryan, and her research on the attitudes of families toward their gay and lesbian children. Caitlin has been among the Mormons for the past 4 days, speaking to groups, sharing not only her research, but her extensive wisdom of working in this field as a mental health professional. What she has to say, I think, is groundbreaking, and I think it has significant implications for our community and for our church. And I'm happy to turn the time over to her now. There will be time after Caitlin's presentation for some questions and discussion from the audience, and then we will conclude at 6:15. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob, and welcome to everyone. Can you hear me back there? I'm going to have to contort myself a little bit to so that you can hear me in the mic and I can actually advance these slides. So if I look like a service animal, please forgive me. Oh, that's great. Oh, thanks. Thanks, Ron. Oh, that's perfect. That's a little easier. Thank you very much. In 2001, I was approached by a large health foundation that wanted to look at the emergence of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender health and disparities issues. In terms of the health programs that they were putting in place, so they offered me an opportunity to submit a research proposal that I thought would make a difference. And what I realized at the time was that no one had done a study on how families were adjusting when lesbian, gay youth, transgender adolescents came out as adolescents, as actually has increasingly been happening over the past 10 years. So I took that opportunity to do what is the first project of its kind, and therefore we now finally have the first research that really shows how do families adjust and adapt when young people come out as gay or transgender during adolescence. And how do families express acceptance and rejection of their gay and transgender children? And then finally, how does that affect their health, mental health, and well-being as young adults? We published our first paper in Pediatrics in January. It went all over the world, really, in about 28 days, because it's the first research of its kind. It's the first research actually to make that connection between family behaviors and health and mental health outcomes. So let me walk you through it, show you some of the materials that we're developing to help families, and show you one of our video stories of ethnically diverse families and their journey from conflict to support of their gay and transgender children. And Bob will have an opportunity to tie this together in terms of implications for LDS families. I'll also be happy to answer your questions both in the session and afterwards, and you can, of course, follow up with me after I leave to go back to San Francisco. We know from all of the major studies of adolescents that family and school are critical in terms of protective factors against major health risks. But until we started this project, we didn't really know that about this project. What I really want to do is give you a sense of the science behind this. I think it's important for you to understand how we did the research and what we found. We'll have an opportunity to talk about how to apply these findings in your community. As I mentioned, this is not only the first research of its kind, but we've been funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation through a matching grant to develop the first family-related approach to keeping gay and transgender children in their families, promoting well-being, and helping those families learn how to support their gay and transgender children. I happen to be a clinical social worker, so I'm not only going to do research that sits on a shelf, I really want to do a study, and that's what the study is all about, that has a number of different implications. We have an educational component to disseminate our findings directly to family members and youth, to providers and policymakers, as well as through the media. We are developing a whole new family-related approach that doesn't currently exist anywhere. And when we're through with those interventions and we've disseminated them across the U.S. and to groups we're working with in other countries, we'll do a whole professional training component across disciplines and systems of care. And finally, there's a public policy component in terms of reframing how we work with lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender adolescents in custodial care. As many of you may know, gay youth are disproportionately represented among homeless youth. A very high proportion end up being expelled from their homes, and also in foster care and the juvenile justice system. And how we think of gay youth is very risk-ridden, rather than as a population to invest in to promote their well-being as adults. One of the challenges in doing this work is that across all the disciplines, from pediatrics to social work, even to foster care, we really serve gay youth as individuals, alone, and not in the context of their families. Unlike their heterosexual peers, if there's a problem that a provider discovers with that adolescent and it requires parental involvement, they think nothing of saying to the youth, you know, we need to bring mom and dad in. We really need to sit down and talk about this, and I'll be here with you to help you. But when it comes to gay youth, there's a perception that families can't help their children, that they'll be unsupportive at best, that at worst, they'll end up being expelled from their homes. And there's a lot of history behind that. There's also no information that shows how we can help families until our new research has really come out. So this is a very different approach, and yet it's across all the systems of care. It's important to keep that in mind. Some may think, gosh, you know, serving gay youth in the context of their families, that seems like something that we should be done. But in fact, what we're doing is really a revolutionary act. So not only do we have to change all of the systems of care, but we really have to change how services are being provided in the gay community at large, because even in those services, gay youth are served alone. We did a survey twice of all of the LGBT community centers, gay youth programs, all the PFLAG chapters. Some of you may be familiar with PFLAG. It's an organization for families with gay and transgender children. It stands for families, parents, families, and friends of lesbians and gays. There are other groups like this, for example, Family Fellowship. But in California, when we did this survey in 2004, we only found one service that wasn't really an identified service, but if parents called a certain community center and wanted to get some counseling, they could get it. But it wasn't advertised, so no one really knew about it. Hardly anybody used it. And by the time we finished our survey in 2004, it wasn't available any longer. When we did our survey again at the end of 2008 in December, we actually found two services in the whole state for families with gay and transgender children. And these were in community centers that were outside of the big cities. They were not in San Francisco or LA. And by scoping this out, I really want you to understand that the landscape is very bleak in terms of supporting families with gay and transgender adolescents. And yet, hopefully by the time I finish my presentation, I'll give you a sense of how urgently needed these services are and how we really must. Our research, I think, signifies that we must serve these young people in the context of their families. Some years ago, I had an opportunity under the Clinton administration to convene a conference on the primary care needs of lesbian and gay adolescents, and actually to develop clinical care guidelines for how do we serve these youth in terms of primary care, adolescent mental health, and HIV medical and psychosocial care. So when I did that book, I realized that no one has any idea how the ages of coming out are changing over time, across the decades. So I did this chart, and I've updated it since then, and I use it because I think it's really important to understand that the average age that young people, both heterosexual or homosexual, become aware of that first crush, you know, the kind of posters of somebody special they want to put up on their wall, or that Valentine that they want to give to somebody special in school, that first crush across sexual orientations, regardless of who those young people are, comes on average about age 10. So even though there's a perception that young people know they're heterosexual from very early ages, and there's a myth that you have to be an adult, really, to know that you're gay, these young people at about age 10 are dealing with their first realization that they're attracted to another person of the same gender. This looks a little complicated, but I'll explain it to you. These are important developmental milestones for young people, and This is research on adults who came out in the 1970s. And you can see that back in the 70s, that first awareness of sexual attraction was in high school, in essence. And when people came out, they came out as adults. Very few people came out as adolescents because the sanctions were so great. There were no services. There was no support. And more importantly, many people never came out across the course of their lives and come out to their family members, to their friends, or even to themselves. A number of things happened in these intervening years between the 1970s and the early 1990s, and one of the most important was the emergence of the internet. So for the very first time, we could find information about things that weren't talked about publicly online, but also people could get direct access to information about human sexuality. And that's one of the things that happened. At the same time, we had the emergence of many, many LGBT youth support programs all over the country, so that as young people were coming out at younger ages, they could have a friend. They could find a place to go that was supervised, where they could get access to information, go to the movies together, have supported recreational activities, and get reduce that terrible isolation that has driven so many young people to commit suicide. We also saw the emergence of diversity clubs in schools all over the country that again provided more access to information. So really by the late 1980s and the early 90s, we see a dramatic shift, a drop in that average age of identifying that first crush for both gay and straight kids to about an average age of 10, young people coming out in high schools on average. And if we move forward to the time period when we did the first part of our study, the Family Acceptance Project, we see that young people were identifying coming out at a little bit over age 13, and their families are finding out a little bit over a year later. What the biologists who talked about this say is that there is no difference in that age of same-sex or sexual attraction or opposite-sex sexual attraction. It all has to do with early child development and adrenarche, the development of the adrenal glands when hormones are starting to be produced. So young people begin to get those first feelings of attraction. This is very important because it means that young people in about fourth grade are really struggling with these issues, and unfortunately so many of them are really struggling with them in isolation. So knowing this, I wanted to do this study. I believe that today, most people come out during adolescence, even though they may not share that information with their immediate family. I wanted to find out, how do families express acceptance and rejection of their gay and transgender child? And most importantly, how do those behaviors that express acceptance and rejection affect different kinds of health and mental health outcomes? Risk for HIV, suicide, depression, substance abuse, self-esteem, life satisfaction, sense of the future. So that's, in fact, what this project is all about. This is a complex research project. It has a whole series of linked studies. The first study that we actually did was a major interview-based study of gay and transgender adolescents all over California and their families. So we did outreach through the schools, through youth programs, through health programs, through the whole out-of-home youth network, through faith-based programs, and with youth themselves. And we went all over the state into the farm worker country, the coastal village, urban centers. About a quarter of the young people and families in our study came from rural or semi-rural areas. About a quarter were out of home. So that meant that we actually sat in the kitchens or living rooms of families that had thrown their children out of the home, families whose children were in foster care or juvenile justice, most of them as a result of conflict related to their identity. We did 2 to 4 hour individual interviews with each adolescent, at least one parent or guardian, grandparents, aunts and uncles, older siblings, to learn their story, to learn about the family system, early childhood development, gender expression, how families express religious values and beliefs related to the child's identity, cultural issues, school experiences, peer experiences, where the family turned to for help, and of course hopes and dreams for the future. not only did we learn an enormous amount about these families and their gay and transgender children, but we also identified over 100 different behaviors that parents and caregivers use to express acceptance and rejection of their gay and transgender children. And then in the second part of our study, we did a linked survey that actually looked at how do gay and transgender young adults ages 21 to 25 who are out to at least one parent or guardian during adolescence, how do these experiences of acceptance and rejection affect their health and mental health as young adults? We analyzed all of that data. We then took it back to many of the same families in the first part of our study and very ethnically diverse families. So other families that we hadn't talked to previously. And not only did we do those sessions with very diverse families, but we also did those sessions in English, Spanish, and Chinese. We found many of the same kinds of reactions across families. One of the things we asked families was, when we're developing educational materials for families, what should it look like? What should it include? What are the most important issues that you've learned? How do we talk to families from your cultural background? And so one of the things we've done is to develop our first family education materials, and these have been given out. We'll be developing actually more of these, and ultimately they'll be available on our website. We learned an enormous amount in these briefing sessions on how we could actually help families. We did those briefing sessions over at least a couple of years, and we got great information about how to help families understand this, families from diverse educational and cultural backgrounds. And that actually has formed the framework for the family-related services that we're developing now. Our project was participatory, and what that really means is a kind of a fancy word for all the end users of our work were sitting around the table with us. Families, youth, young adults, pediatricians, nurses, social workers, community folks, who helped us understand what we were learning as we were learning it. And that's an ongoing part of the work that we do, that we're very connected to the community and to individuals who use our work. This is a very sort of a wonky slide, but it shows you that there are a number of different parts of our study, a number of different linked studies that we've done over really a period of time since 2002 that are helping us understand these findings and how best to use them. In our interviews with youth and families all over California, I expected that we would find families that were rejecting, ambivalent, or accepting. But of course we found them, because it wouldn't have been helpful if we wanted to learn what's happening in families and we only looked at accepting families, so we looked at a full range. But we found something that I actually didn't know existed, and as Ron told you, I've worked in the field for a very long time. We actually found celebratory families. So we found families who celebrated who their children were from the very first point of learning who they were. And because we're doing this work in Chinese, I thought you'd like to see the Chinese characters, because I think they look pretty cool. In terms of what does rejection mean to us and how are we seeing it expressed, these are very negative reactions that are the immediate reactions from families when they learn that their child is gay or transgender. And families learn in a variety of ways, not just from the youth telling them. About 30%, about a third of families were rejecting when they first learned about their child's identity. They expressed that in a variety of ways, everything from expressing shame or blaming the child when they were discriminated against by others. We saw things such as when the family was in public or in a public venue, that they would actually physically separate, even in church, from that child, sending a message, they don't really belong to us. And of course, the most extreme behavior would be ejecting that young person from the home so that they would become homeless. The largest proportion of families were ambivalent, over 50%. Their reaction was very mixed. It was always, I love you, but. And there was always a message to the but that there was something wrong with that young person. About one in five families, when they first learned about their child's identity, were accepting. And these families expressed that acceptance with affection, by welcoming their gay friends or peers to the home, by trying to help that child get accurate information about who they were so that they could have a good life, and by expressing interest and desire to learn about these issues. A small proportion were celebratory, but what's really exciting is we've seen them across ethnic groups. And I'll just tell you one story of a Latino immigrant family. This young person came out to his said to his mom at age 7, "I like boys." And, you know, his mom reacted supportively, didn't extinguish his response. But by the time he was age 10, he said, "You know, Mom, you've taught me to be honest about who I am and not to tell a lie. And, you know, the other boys are all saying they have girlfriends and they're asking me, who's my girlfriend? And I don't want to lie. I want to be honest. And I know it's just going to get harder. So I want to tell them who I am." So he said, "I want to come out in school. I want to tell my classmates." Mother was very concerned about the thought of what could happen to her son. She talked to the teacher. They planned something over a period of time. The teacher thought that this could be handled appropriately and supportively. So the mom wasn't sure, and she decided to have a party the next day to have this on a Friday. So she baked cupcakes and decorated them and brought them to class with her son. They planned a party the next day for the whole family, the extended family, to come. And because there were other siblings in the family, they asked the extended family to bring gifts for all the children, because this was a coming out party for her 10-year-old son. I'm happy to say that the experience in school actually went really well. His classmates were very supportive. And this little boy of age 10 wrote a poem and said, "I'm just a boy who likes to collect butterflies, and I like to play ball, and I like to do all of these things." And it ended with a simple sentence, "And I'm gay." That actually is an embodiment, I think, of a celebratory family. These are families that support who their children are, enabling them to unfold just as they are without trying to change them. The fact that we saw them in African-American, white, Latino, and Chinese-American families was really pretty amazing, and I believe that as we do more and more of this work, we'll discover them in other places. And it actually helps us unpack this very wide range of reactions. And also in this study, which for us and for me personally has been really the most hopeful experience I've ever had, I've seen an enormous amount of hope, because we saw families who started out as being very rejecting, you know, increasingly become supportive of their gay and transgender children. So these are some of the data, I believe, that can help families become supportive even more quickly. Because now that we've linked acceptance and rejection to healthy mental health behaviors, the outcomes are pretty dramatic. So in our young adult survey, we developed new ways to ask these questions about these accepting and rejecting behaviors. And half of that study actually looked at their experience as a younger person, and the other half looks at their well-being as young adults. So these are some of the kinds of negative family reactions that we measured. I'm sure many of you are familiar in the news and other places. It's very common for rejecting families to believe that their child might be gay or transgender, to restrict access to any kind of positive information, including peers or community resources, to try to change their child's sexual orientation or gender expression, and to tell them the way that they are is shameful to the family, so silence and secrecy need to be maintained. We measured over 50 different positive behaviors, and these included supporting the child's identity and expression, welcoming their gay friends and partners to family activities, finding positive information to give them a positive sense of the future. A sense of the future, having hope, is very, very important for child and adolescent development. And finding positive adult role models to give them a sense of guidance for the future. One of the things I want to say is that families who express these rejecting behaviors were acting out of love and concern. They were trying to help their children fit in. They were trying to help them find support from their peers to live a good life. And in their mind, in their way of thinking, the way they had been taught by others, including authority figures, was the only way to do this was to try to change the child in an external way. So these are some of the kinds of things that we've learned in our study about how these accepting and rejecting behaviors affect young people. It looks a little intimidating, but I'll explain it to you. These are actually symptoms of depression in the past week. And what we looked at was families that the young person experienced as being not at all rejecting, a little, somewhat, very accepting, accepting, or extremely accepting. So in families that were not at all accepting compared with extremely, these young people were reporting twice as many symptoms of depression in the past week. And that's important because depression underlies a lot of health problems, including a sense of hopelessness, lack of belief that you could have a future. It's connected to many different kinds of diseases as well. When we looked at substance abuse problems, we both looked at use of substances, use of illegal drugs, as well as having problems with substance use. And for those of you who are health providers who are with us today, you know that when someone talks about having a blackout, getting arrested, getting into a fight, losing a friend, having family conflict because of those substance use, those are actually indicators of addiction. So they're much more serious than just using alcohol, for example. And we see that in families that were not at all accepting compared with extremely, those young people, again, are reporting twice as many problems related to addiction as young people from families that are extremely accepting. We looked at thoughts about suicide, about taking your own life. And this slide looks at the past 6 months. So what we found was that in families that were not at all accepting, almost 60% of these young adults were thinking of taking their own life in the past 6 months, compared with 8% in families that are extremely accepting. And one of the things we found in our study that's really important, you can really see very dramatically here, which is that a little bit of change. Some of you who are health providers will have heard the term harm reduction. Just a little bit less of those rejecting behaviors can make an extraordinary difference in a young person's well-being. And that was a message that families really took to heart from our study. I don't have to change who I am, but if I just change my behavior a little bit, I can make things better for my son or daughter. We looked at self-esteem, and you know that self-esteem is at the root of thinking that you're a good person, that you're a worthwhile person, that you can have a good life. It's at the root of self-care behaviors, like wearing a seatbelt or using a condom. And you can see that in families that were not at all rejecting, that that young person's self-esteem was so much higher compared to families that were extremely rejecting. What's important in our study is that we found the same kinds of outcomes, that when families were more supportive, well-being was much higher than when families were not at all supportive or very rejecting. We looked at social support, and we saw that in families that were not at all rejecting compared with extremely, those young people who had family support had so many more people in their lives as young adults to give them a richer, fuller life, a sense of well-being, good fellowship, if you will. We looked at their ability to think that they could have a happy life, a good life as a young adult, as a gay person. And in families that were extremely rejecting, only 25% believed that they could have a good life. But in families that are not at all rejecting, almost 90% believe that they could have a good life. And again, this underscores a sense of hope, a sense of well-being, that I could have a good life, be connected to my family, have a job, be successful. These are very, very important things for future orientation. We also took our sample and we broke it up into three groups, which we thought was an easier way for families to understand a lot of acceptance or a lot of rejection kind of in the middle, and a little bit of acceptance or no acceptance and a little rejection or no rejection. And so this was a way we thought to communicate these important findings. So here what we're looking at is actual illegal drug use, and we see that in families that were highly rejected during adolescence, as young adults, those young people are more than three times as likely to use illegal drugs. But families that are moderately rejecting, that illegal drug use is cut in half. This is important because, again, we saw it with all of these different behaviors. We saw risk for HIV infection, very serious outcome in families that were highly rejected during adolescence. These young adults were almost 3.5 times as likely to be at high risk for HIV. And if you think about the root, that lack of self-esteem, that sense that I'm not a good person, I'm not a worthwhile person, I don't have a sense of the future, I'm living now. These kinds of beliefs underscore those high levels of risk. But again, that risk is cut in half with moderate levels of family rejection during adolescence. When we looked at suicide, it was actually the most startling, and it was in fact even higher than I expected. We found that in families that were highly rejecting during adolescence, those young adults were more than 8.5 times as likely to have attempted suicide at least once. And families that were moderately rejecting could cut that risk of actual attempted suicide by 3/4 with moderate levels of rejection. And this is especially important because we know with suicide attempts, you just have to get it right once, and that's really the end of someone's life. We found for families that suicide and HIV were very alarming, and while families often talk of consequences for children in terms of teaching children about behavior and outcome, families, because this information had never been available, never thought of consequences in terms of their words, actions, and behavior on the well-being of their gay and transgender children. So we also looked at gender conformity, and we looked at families where they tried to change that child's gender expression, tried to make them more or less masculine or feminine over a period of time. And we found by the time these folks were young adults that they were at much higher risk for depression, suicide attempts, illegal drug use, and risk for HIV infection.
Caitlin, can
yes.
you go back to the previous slide?
This one?
That's 857% of what?
Of none. It's 8.5 times more likely than no or low levels of rejection.
Why don't you state it then?
I'm sorry?
Why don't you state it that way, Ben? I'm just confused. But so it's 8.5 times as likely to be involved in suicide in high regard as the high rate of rejection.
Yes.
As the 8.5 times more likely than what?
Than when families have no or low levels of rejection. In other words, a family that does not reject their child. So you have a family that does not reject their child, and another family that is highly rejecting, and I'll show you what those rejecting behaviors are, and that young person in the highly rejecting family is more than 8.5 times as likely to try to take their own life at least once. Some obviously have attempted multiple times. Does that answer your question?
It answered my question.
Okay. Well, it's the statistical analysis, so I didn't want to completely take the percentages off because I wanted to have a reference point. Some people, the percentages might mean more to them than the pictures. So what did we find in our study? For the first time, actually, we were able to show that family rejection of an LGBT young person is associated with serious health and mental health outcomes. And while that may seem logical, it had never actually been shown with research before, so this is the first time that's been done. We've also seen in our work that family acceptance is both an important protective factor and it promotes well-being for gay and transgender youth. And that brings us back, really, when I started, talking this evening, that what we know about research for adolescents in general is that families are such an important protective factor. Well, now finally we've shown that families can be an extremely important protective factor for gay and transgender adolescents as well. And we really didn't know that. I know that those of you in the back of the room, this is probably really hard to see, but I'll speak at it a little bit for you. We took those rejecting behaviors and we identified more than 50 of them, and we did more analysis to actually show which are the rejecting behaviors that put young people at the greatest risk. And we were not surprised to find physical and verbal abuse related to their identity. But what we also found, that I didn't know it would be the same as physical abuse, was blocking access to information about being gay, or resources, or having a gay friend, or physically distancing that child from family events and activities, you know, preventing them from attending. These behaviors of blocking access to gay friends and peers or excluding the child from family activities had a 9 times greater risk, all of them, of attempted suicide. We didn't expect to see that, and we were very, very startled to see that. But this kind of analysis enables us to rank these behaviors in terms of which are the riskiest behaviors in terms of outcomes, all the way down. And we found that when young people were discriminated against by others, blaming them for that experience, well, that wouldn't happen if you didn't tell people that you were gay, requiring them to maintain secrecy and silence, expressing shame. This is a shameful behavior, so that a sense of shame is internalized by that young person, pressuring them to enforce gender conformity, using religion and religious-based beliefs to condemn that young child. Those kinds of behaviors significantly increased risk. We also looked, our study is strengths-based, so we looked at positive coping, wellness, strengths of families. How can families support that child's well-being? And so we did the same analysis with the wellness-promoting behaviors, over 50 of them, and we found that the most wellness-promoting behaviors were believing that your child could have a good life, could have a happy life as a gay adult, supporting their gender expression, welcoming their gay friends and partners into the home, connecting them with a positive role model to give them a sense of the future, what their options are, advocating for them when they're mistreated against because of their identity, seeing them as a positive young person that the parent wants to invest in, supporting using religion and religious values in terms of expression and belief to support who that young person is, requiring that family members respect that young person and not make disparaging negative comments or actions because of who they are, all the way down really to for families that are very conflicted and having a really hard time just beginning to deal with this, just sitting and talking with your child about what they're feeling, about their identity, about what it means for them, without punishing them or expressing negative reactions, just sitting with them and talking. That's a very, very important first step that we actually recommend for families that don't know where to start and don't really know where to go. One of the things that we did was we took these very negative behaviors and we developed a rapid risk assessment tool that pediatricians, nurses, social workers, etc. can use, because it's going to take a while for us to develop our new family-related approach and disseminate it around the country. So because of what we found, we know how serious this is, and we want to communicate this information to families as quickly as we can. So we developed a rapid risk screener that I'm in the process of writing up now. We took 6 questions that are the most risk-promoting questions, such as excluding the child from family events or activities, preventing them from having gay friends or partners, preventing them from accessing materials or participating in events related to LGBT issues, telling them that there would be negative sanctions in terms of their religion because they were gay, if peers harassed them, blaming them for that harassment. This is a rapid risk assessment tool that a provider can use in a matter of minutes, and in a matter of minutes they can find out what's the level of family rejection, and then they would know how that rejection affects different kinds of health and mental health outcomes. Providers then could make a determination: this child is at high risk, we need to bring the family in and talk with them and provide this new information for families. So just to show you what happens when all of these questions occur, 5 to 6 of them, 7 in, when 5 to 6 of these experiences are present, 7 in 10 of these young people are reporting very high levels of depression, high enough that require medication. 8 in 10 have attempted suicide. Of those, 65% required medical care. 8 and 10 have substance use problems, again, that are indications of addiction, which means that they're very serious. And 6 and 10 have already had a diagnosis with a sexually transmitted disease. And for HIV, which is predominantly transmitted through sexual transmission, this is very, very serious. So how are we dealing with this now, these findings, before we can get to our family-related strategies or interventions, whatever you want to call them? Well, we're doing three different things right now. The first is we're developing a whole series of family education materials. We are also producing brief video stories of ethnically, socially, and religiously diverse families that show their journey from conflict to support. And the reason for these video stories is that you heard me talk about the dearth of services for families with gay or transgender teens. That means families don't know how to find other families, they don't have other parents to talk to, they don't have a way that they can get hope for the future. So these stories are designed to show the journey from conflict to support of families, to give both families hope and youth hope, and eventually we'll disseminate them in a lot of different ways. And in fact, I'm looking for an LDS family right now that would be willing to do a video with us. I'm going to show you one of the videos today that we just finished about a week and a half ago. We also are developing a whole series of policy and practice materials, like the rapid risk assessment tool and provider training materials that we're beginning to put out now. And finally, we're publishing over time a whole series of academic publications in peer-reviewed journals. The pediatrics paper was the first one. We have several others in the pipeline. We have, if I don't run out of gas, maybe 100, 150 research papers in this data set, because we have so much data. Just from the family interviews alone, we have about 8,000 pages of transcripts of these extraordinary, remarkable stories. So, my father's hobby was carpentry. And you know, when you build a house, you start with the foundation. So basically, the foundation for our work is not our opinions, it's not conjecture, it's really empirical research. And I think that's important because families, when they're looking at what we've done, we can basically say to them, everything that we've learned has come from families and lived experiences. It's not really anything that we've made up. So this is our family education booklet. We've got guidelines on serving gay and transgender youth in out-of-home care. For those of you who are interested in transgender children and adolescents, this is really a great book that was recently published and includes some of the principles from our research. These are actually the population groups, the target groups of providers, clergy, services, institutions that we are beginning to disseminate our work to right now. Our approach is really to work with national organizations, both mainstream, faith-based, professional associations, and community groups, to help them understand that now when we see gay or transgender youth in our practices, in our communities, in all kinds of settings, we must always think of them in the context of their families, and really believe that to see families as allies that we can engage in helping educate them, because we believe that families want the best for their children, and that's their basic motivation. And in essence, because this information has never been available before, our aim really now is to educate across all of the disciplines and community groups and across jurisdictions, and that's a pretty huge job. So the first things that we've actually been doing is a lot of national conferences. I'm going to jump to this one because when I talk about interventions, people think, oh, what does that mean? Is that, yikes, you know, that sounds like a serious word. But these are really very simple strategies. One is educational. So in other words, it's helping families understand the myths and misconceptions about sexual orientation and gender identity, helping them understand the research that we found and what does it mean. And that's why in our family education booklet, you'll see it's written at about a 10th grade reading level. I'm now raising funds with our cultural literacy specialist to do this at a 6th grade and also at a 3rd and a 4th grade reading level in different languages, so that families from different educational backgrounds can really understand how this information relates to them. Some families need more communication skills. So the skill building piece of what we're doing, a fancy word to talk about that is cognitive behavioral. It's actually helping families do a self-assessment. What kinds of behaviors are we doing now? How can we help decrease these behaviors that put our children at greatest risk and start to potentially increase some of these behaviors that really can support our child's well-being? And finally, one of the most important is peer support. Families need to find other families like themselves. And you have a very important resource here for the LDS community in terms of family fellowship, which is really all over the state and is really a wonderful organization for families with gay children. And that I know that members are here today and would be happy to talk with you about how to get information. So our approach really is one that values belief systems, faith traditions of very diverse families. We're not there to change their beliefs. We're really there to meet families where they are and empower them with this new research information so they can make what they think are the decisions in their child's best interest. You really can't change somebody from without. You know, that has to come from within. And because we believe that families love their children and want the best for them, we think when they hear this information, they're going to be highly motivated to figure out what can they do that's appropriate for their family to help their child. We want to help maintain those children in their homes because they're disproportionately represented out of the home. And so many of those young people were expelled through an unfortunate negative reaction, sometimes through family violence, a parent saying, I don't ever want to see you again, but in their heart not really meaning that. I have to tell you that because I've now interviewed many rejected families, I'll just give you an example of one mom who said, you know, I put my head on the pillow every night. I don't know where my daughter is in the world. I hope she's safe. And so many of these families where something may have erupted, I know that if they could have done something differently, they would have. And that's one of the hopes we have in terms of getting this information out. We think it's important for people like you to talk about this information in your groups and families and with your colleagues to raise awareness of this research across our institutions. Most important to encourage parents to talk with their children when they think that these are issues for their children or when they know they are, rather than maintaining silence and secrecy, which doesn't help. And it's very important for parents to get peer support. This is actually our web page and my email address. It's on the information that we've given out. What I'd like to do is to show this video, and then we can have an opportunity for Bob to frame this and for us to discuss this in the context of your experiences. And hopefully this will work.
Marine dad, I had to name him Edward, which is my name. He just was bright-eyed and ready to go right from the get-go.
I don't remember how the Barbie started, but I just remember that he ended up with a Little Mermaid doll, and he really enjoyed playing with it, and that was okay with me. You know, it was a little harder for Ed because being the Marine and very macho, he had a hard time with it.
I'd take his Little Mermaid and I'd throw it in the trash. And of course, in the meantime, I'd gone down and bought 3 or 4 G.I. Joes, and I'd have his G.I. Joes, so I'd put him in the same place where the mermaid was, hoping that he would pick up the G.I. Joe. And he didn't like it.
I just remember talking to Ed and saying, you know, every time the mermaid disappears, the Little Mermaid, I'm just going to buy another one, whether you like it or not. And that's just the way it is. If EJ likes the Little Mermaid, he likes the Little Mermaid. And if he wants to play with it, that's fine. It made him happy. And so if it made him happy, then it was okay with me.
I think I was conscious that he didn't really like certain things that I would do. Like, my friend Nina lived with us, and we would call it sisters, and we'd wear like little dresses and play with Barbies and stuff like that.
He wasn't like the typical boys that I had grown up with, so that there was a gap that started to occur there in our relationship.
I think I did a lot in order to deny it and push it away, because I just wanted to be accepted by my parents. I just hated school and didn't want to be there. The guys would call you faggot or queer or gay or girl or whatever.
He would come and talk about this kid picking on him or that kid picking on him, and I would get angry with him because I'd feel like he was a pushover for kids. He was a target, and he allowed them to do it.
This started in about 7th or 8th grade. There was just some depression going on, and he was very isolated. He didn't have a lot of friends.
I did a lot of friend searching in 7th grade on. And I'd say the people that were most accepting were the people who did drugs and drank, because whenever you do drugs and drink, you love everybody. And so I felt like when I did that, I was accepted. That was good enough for me. Any sort of acceptance that I could get, or any friends I could make doing whatever I did, I would do it. I knew they were bad news, and then when they got my parents definitely knew they were bad news, and so they didn't want me hanging out with them. And so I would get mad at my parents for not letting me go out, and it would just create this whole cycle of I just be stuck in my room.
We went to the medical doctor, and he started getting medicine for depression, but we still had not really talked about the issue of him being gay. We never really addressed it.
I figured I couldn't talk to my dad about it, I didn't want to, because I already knew what he thought about it.
When EJ came out to me, I really had already known about it. I really had. And yes, it was painful to have EJ tell me that, only because I'd always hoped that it wasn't so. I'd always hoped that it was a phase and that he'd grow out of it. And it never happened. About maybe a month and a half into high school, EJ asked one night if he could go to the homecoming football game. And then following the football game was a homecoming dance. And we thought, wow, that's great. You know, we just got some friends. He's going to go to this homecoming dance. He'll have a good time, and good for him. Maybe things are going like we thought they would, or hoped that they would for him. I called EJ just to check on him. And when I spoke to him on the phone, he sounded like he was slurring a little bit.
I knew something was wrong. I tell Edward, get on the phone again. I'm afraid that he's not going to answer. We need to find him. I don't know how we're going to find him there.
I got there, and Vinny was completely slumped over, passed out. He had no shoes on, and I was holding him with my arm, and I was dragging him. He couldn't walk. He said, "Papa, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I want to be normal like everyone else. I just want to be normal." I felt desperation for him.
When he woke up, he told me the same thing. He says, "Mom, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to fit in, and I just want to be normal." And I'll just never forget those words. And I told him, I said, "You know what? You are normal."
Nobody knew what he was on, if he had overdosed on drugs or what he had done. It turned out that it was definitely alcohol poisoning. We were pretty disappointed in him that he had done that. But we also realized that we needed help.
The information that we found was absolutely frightening. We went to just a couple of different websites, and they talked about, at that time, that there was an estimated 7 million gay teens in the United States, that 50% of those teens that came out to their family would suffer physical, psychological, or emotional abuse, or become homeless, be thrown out of their home. I couldn't imagine any of those for EJ. The statistics for HIV, STDs, drugs, alcohol, attempted suicide, it was crazy. That's where EJ was headed. It was obvious to us. And if we didn't do something, then we were going to lose him.
It was really Elizabeth's idea that said, you know, we really should try to do something here and start something.
I guess for me it was more emotional, and for him it was emotional, but what really hit home with him was when he saw those cold, hard facts, those statistics, that this is what was going to happen to his son if he didn't make a change, if he didn't get more information, if we didn't do something for ourselves and for him.
We started looking in the community actually for a place that would help us. I wanted to talk to another dad like me. I wanted to find out, what did he do? What do you do? I wanted to find out from an experienced dad that was going through the same thing as I was going through at that time or around this time. And I couldn't find anybody.
Then we started looking for a youth group. There was nothing anywhere. And I told him, you know what? We're going to have to start a youth group. And he said, okay.
EJ had been raised all of his life in a Christian church. And shortly after he came out, he came to me and said, Dad, am I going to go to hell?
When EJ said that, what did hit home with me was, well, we've been going to churches, and no one has ever stood there and said, homosexuality is an abomination. But the undertone, the undercurrent, and the under-message was that. And I never really let it bother me. But I should have paid attention because EJ was paying attention.
I thought to myself in silence, everything I've ever been taught is that it's an abomination, and yes, he's going to hell. But I also quickly thought, my son is a beautiful kid. He's compassionate, he's warm, he cares for people, he's respectful, he's kind. How could, if we have such a loving God, how can God condemn my son to hell?
And that's what was the beginning of our search for a church and a place to start the youth group.
We went to 15 different churches. We found this particular church that Elizabeth found on the internet that was, it stated on there, was open and affirming. I had no idea what that meant.
We walked in and he accepted us with open arms like we were family.
Open and affirming means that the church is open to gay people or anyone.
EJ felt comfortable there, and we all did.
Even in our case, we use it for questioning. So it was anybody.
it's just wonderful. We have a meeting twice a month, and they keep showing up.
And we're helping 50 kids that come to our group every second and fourth of the month for an hour and a half.
We're supposed to be done at 9 o'clock. At 10:30, I have to shoo the kids out. They don't want to go home.
A month and a half or two after he did come out, my 16-year-old, Evan, was talking about having his girlfriend over, and one of the kids said, EJ, when are you going to bring somebody over? And EJ said, I would never think of doing something like that. I wouldn't want to disappoint Dad. I thought about that for a second, and I thought, how unfair. How unfair for my son to feel like he couldn't bring somebody that he's attracted to over. I felt terrible.
When you're with someone, you're proud of being with them, and you want to show them to your parents. And I remember thinking, like, never will I ever bring anybody home to meet my dad. Like, that's just out of the question. But, like, for PJ, I think it's worth it. I mean, he's my first boyfriend. I've never had a boyfriend before. We've been together for, like, a year, a month now.
I said, EJ, it may be a little awkward for me, son, but I'll deal with it because I love you. And I think that was a turning point for my relationship with EJ.
I'm so proud of my husband and how far he's come. I'm so proud of EJ. I'm proud of myself. My son Evan, our little children, we're not the most perfect family. We fight, we argue, you know, I mean, kids throw tantrums. I scream and yell sometimes when I shouldn't. But we're just really happy.
My hair getting a lot better.
Maybe I'm old.
What do you think it is? It's
probably
20% gray or?
No.
How much?
Probably 30% gray.
Come on. As I look back now, I'm not disappointed in my son at all. I'm proud of my son who he is.
I don't have proof in any tangible way, but I know in my heart that we have made a difference in EJ's life. That he's not going to turn to drugs or alcohol. Not that he won't experiment, but that he's not going to become another statistic.
I believe with my heart that gay people don't choose to be gay. They just are. No more than I choose to be brown skin. It is what it is.
It all came from love. Because, an unselfish love. Because when you get out of your own self and look at what is EJ going through, how is he being affected, this is your child who is hurting and in pain, who is searching and trying to find himself. How can we not do anything? There was no choice.
Where they're going shooting. Okay. I think you can see how much work we have to do in our own community, but I'm encouraged by the fact that knowledge is power. Example is power. Being together in an understanding of what's possible is power. So I'll have a few concluding remarks to say, but in the 15 minutes we have left, if any of you have questions for Caitlin that you'd like to ask her, we welcome you to come here and use this microphone. And Caitlin, if you and I want to go up here, we can do that.
Thank you. Dr. Ryan, you are Galileo Galilei, and you came here to Rome, to the Vatican, to try to tell us, but also the institution, the Mormon Church, I guess, that the Earth is moving around the sun. And they know it, but they have been saying something different for so many years, and some people are so afraid of the consequences of changing the point of view that they refuse to do it. Next month, Evergreen International, an organization that is associated with the Mormon Church, will bring Dr. Joseph Nicolosi. I guess you would call him the inventor of so-called reparative therapy. He's going to be the keynote speaker of the conference. What would you respond to that?
I don't know that I could respond to that. I'd love to have Bob's help to respond to that, if I might. I think, as Bob said, and he'll add a segue to this, that knowledge is power. You know, I'm struggling now in collaboration with lots of groups. And by the way, many jurisdictions are interested in our work. You'll be heartened to know that groups in 15 countries, including China, are following what we're doing. And next year, I'm going to take our work to China, to multiple cities. And in fact, the government of Barcelona is actually translating all of our work into Catalan. So there is I think this is a very important time historically, politically, in terms of we didn't have the capacity of the internet, you know, as developed as it is. You know, I was doing this work much earlier. It was so isolating for parents, for families, for someone who wanted to help their children get this information. I'm relying on Sunstone to help me get this information out. In my profession, social work, we say that we have at least four significant others who, you know, are connected to four other significant others. I think so many people turn to their family for advice and information, you know, before they turn to anyone else. They may turn to a medical authority, religious figure, but a family is often a first source of information. And I guess I'd like to say that is a critical disseminator of what you've learned here. We'll have our family education materials up on the internet, you know, as soon as we can get them up over at the university, so that people can learn this information. It's in the three largest language groups in the world. That was our decision in terms of doing our work. I can't personally convince people otherwise. I think that the way I think to convince is by example, and of course the power of science. You know, LDS as a faith is very open to science and education and research, and I'm very heartened by that. Our work will be published in the top-tiered peer-reviewed journals. Pediatrics is the most important medical journal for children and adolescents in the world. I think that will help a lot of families that are really struggling with this to hear what we had to say there and in other kinds of you know, the top medical journals. Bob, I'm sure, has some comments about this.
Well, I think that, you know, having spent my whole life in the academic community, I'm aware that some ideas die very hard, and that even evidence cannot convince some people. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that Nicolosi and Bird are right, which they're not, but let's just say for the sake of argument that they are. Those children and those families still need to be loved. That is the most important message from this research, is that love and acceptance and nurturing is the divine birthright of every human being. And any child, no matter what his or her orientation or feelings or whatever, needs to be loved by a family and by a community and hopefully by a faith community. I have said, and I am not a scientist, but I have said that in my experience, 25 years of working and trying to work for change in this arena, I've never met a single person who chose to be gay. I've never met a single person who had not tried to change based on what they were trying to do to conform. And I've never met anyone that could. I only speak of my own experience, but as I look at all of those within the realm of that experience, every one of them needed a parent to extend love to them. Everyone needed a parent to give them time and space, and every one of them needed a home to come home to, and many of them did not.
Caitlin mentioned how important the pediatrics journal is, and that's where the first article from her research was published. I don't know that we mentioned that, but it was in the January issue this year, and then it was featured by an editorial in the journal as well, right, Caitlin?
Well, it was supposed to be featured by an editorial, which signals the most important research to come out, but they actually sped up production because it was so important, and when they forgot to tell us. So that included the pediatrician who was going to write the editorial. So when they went to her and said, "You have 2 weeks," she said, "I don't have time." You know, so we ended up not getting an editorial, but we did have enormous play. In 30 days, it went in 9 countries and 250 reports and featured on All Things Considered in all kinds of places. So I started then getting 200 emails a day from really all over the U.S. and the world, from parents, families, providers. There are now 7 or 8 jurisdictions in the U.S. that actually want to partner with us, that if we had the resources today, I would actually be partnering with Massachusetts and Washington State and various other kinds of jurisdictions in developing, you know, these interventions in multiple sites. I don't have the resources to do that, so I'm just doing it in one. Did you have a comment?
Let me say one more thing, Caitlin.
Okay, sure.
I think one of the most profound findings here, I'm aware of the fact that there are some Latter-day Saint parents who have a big mountain to climb to say to their child, welcome your friend, your gay friends, or whatever, into the home. But look at what just a little bit of acceptance, just a little bit of love, just a little bit of understanding makes a huge difference. So the findings of this research is so significant for its impact on our community that even if we can go part way, it will have a huge difference.
Yeah, I just have a question. Well, I guess several questions that are on the rejecting families, so I'll kind of try and wrap it up. One, I'm wondering about the sample size, and then you kind of spoke to this earlier, but it seems to me that intuitively rejecting families would be more opposed to intervention, especially acceptance is in the title of it, and at the core is the rejection. They're trying to reject the homosexuality. And especially in this community where heterosexuality is very one of the centerpieces of Mormonism or Mormon thought. I'm just wondering how you're addressing that and if that's problematic, because the interventions that you're kind of talking about so far seem more of a macro community-based like education and stuff, but as far as like working directly with like a Mormon family that's rejecting, I think right away they would be like, no, it's too threatening to their core identity.
So sitting with a Mormon family and saying, talking with your child, finding a place to support who they really are is too threatening, because that's education is our first. Education with families around the accepting and rejecting behaviors that we found in our study, not just education in general. Really teaching them what we learned, answering questions about basic misconceptions that they have about sexual orientation and gender identity. And we know across the population, there are really no places where people learn these issues. So there are enormous misconceptions about them among many, many people. We've hardly talked with a family yet, even the ones who are very accepting, that didn't still have a lot of misconceptions about what this meant for them and for their children. So that's, is that what you meant?
Yeah, also though, if you could talk about what was the sample size, how many families were...
Yes.
Consider rejecting?
In our qualitative study, and I don't know if you know about qualitative research, but we had 154 in that sample. That's very large. Each one of those represents 2 to 4 hour interviews plus other kind of quantitative measures. So at a basis, we have 8,000 transcript pages of their experiences.
about 50 pages for each interview if you have rejecting families. They really walked us through the whole process. So about a third of those families were rejecting when they found out about their child's identity. In our young adult survey, the sample size was 254. That's actually where we created new measures of acceptance and rejection and then measured them in the young adult sample. But getting back to the whole issue of using the words acceptance and rejection, those are ends of bookends, if you will. Acceptance is the North Star. For us, in terms of the work that we do, we talk about support and supportive, and I know that that may connote different things in different cultures. But when we talk about helping your gay or transgender child, one basic way to do that is just to sit and talk with your child, just to create a space where you don't punish them for talking with you about what they're feeling. They're not ridiculed, they're not interrupted, where silence is not imposed. Because when we can't talk with anyone, the sense of hopelessness is just so extraordinary and extreme. And our aim is to help maintain that young person in the family. All the research in the social services shows that when a child is removed from the home, regardless of what it's for, and regardless of how bad it was at home, there's still a much higher risk when they're outside. So the aim is, as Bob said, you know, a little bit of harm reduction or a little bit of change is beginning to readjust the equilibrium in that family.
So these families that were termed rejecting, they came to you, right? As far as
well,
answering the
well,
study?
We did outreach. We did outreach, extensive outreach all over the state. We did it over a period of 2 years. We went through multiple sources to find them, including through the whole foster care system, the whole lot of home youth system, primary care settings, youth development institutes, family resource centers, really faith-based programs, pretty much everything you could think of.
And I would suggest to you read some of the, because a lot of these things are answered in the research.
Yeah, I would be interested. So
sure, in the sample size, I think this may be a little wonky for everybody.
Yeah, sorry.
But we did go to great lengths. I mean, it wouldn't have been published in Pediatrics if they didn't think it was well-designed.
I guess the bottom line of my concern, I guess in more like colloquial terms, is that people who are in this mindset probably wouldn't be as open to even having this kind of intervention.
I disagree.
But you're not finding that.
I disagree. I actually think that we haven't given families enough credit, and we also haven't given them information. They love their kids. They don't want to see their kids. I would say that almost all families, maybe there are some because of mental illness or profound dysfunction, where having their child die of suicide would be preferable to them being gay. But I have to believe that most families, if they could save their child, they would do that. If they could save their life, that's something that they would do, and especially if it took a little bit of adjustment. What we found was that because nothing like this has ever been available before, this is a whole new paradigm shift for families as well as providers and systems of care. We didn't find that rejecting families were rejecting their children to hurt them. They were rejecting them, to help them fit in, and that's a very different frame, I think. And that, to me, signals hope, and that families are really there to for us to reach and to help give them, to empower them. We're not there to change them, we're there to empower them, and they'll figure out, you know, how they can do that. Thank you.
One more question? We've got time for one more?
Yeah, we do. Or two.
Worth digging. Thank you, Doctor. As a fellow social worker, me and my partner, hello, thanks for doing this. Two quick questions. The programs you set up, is it something that we as clinicians can take and then use in our areas?
Yes. What we're doing is we're developing a model, and you know how long that takes. We just hired two tricultural social workers to work with us. We're training them. We're creating a whole referral network to refer families with lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, questioning, gender-variant children to begin to develop these services. We're evaluating them, pilot testing them, field testing them, and at the end of this period, starting in 2011, we'll begin writing the protocols, the guidelines, the training manuals, and then we'll be working with NASW, with the American Psychological Association, American Medical Association, American Academy of Family Physicians, etc.,
to disseminate this information. In fact, the American Academy of Family Physicians has said they'd be interested in developing an online CME/CEU course to train practitioners how to do this work. So we're looking at multiple routes to disseminate this, but first we have to evaluate it and find out the most effective ways to work with families with different kinds of needs. Because as you know, as a practitioner, some families come in and all they're really going to need is some educational information and maybe connection to other families. But other families have deep needs for learning how to communicate with their children. And so they're going to take more of those strategies. Thank you.
Another question.
While you're coming up, let me just say, Caitlin has matching grants from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and anyone who's interested in this work and wants to help her see it move more quickly, she'd love to talk to you.
Yeah, what he means is that we're tax deductible and we survive on donations to do this work. Thank you. Thanks, Ron.
How early should parents start working with children who may or may not end up being gay? I'm aware of a 5-year-old boy who shows a definite preference for so-called girls' toys over boys' toys and so on. That seems awfully young to start discussing these things, but do you wait for the child to come to you? Do you intervene and talk it over with the child? What do you do with a 5-year-old?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking it. Actually, for those moms out there who are especially observant and the dads are observant, you know that children start expressing gender behavior at around ages 2 and 3. So if you're waiting until age 5, they've already been expressing preferences for certain kinds of toys, and parents who are horrified that a little boy would want to play with a Barbie are typically taking the Barbie out and replacing it with a truck, or, you know, those kinds of reactions. I think there are a couple of things here. One of the most interesting things for us was when we did those briefing sessions, we actually heard the same kinds of reactions from families across cultures and even from different languages, that families said to us, we need to know this information about how to help our children before we know who they'll become. That means that I said things as a dad or I said things as a mom about gay people or about sissies or before I ever knew who my children would become. And we know that children are absorbing language, they're learning language. And so many of these gay children know that who they are is bad because of language and what they've heard in multiple settings before they really figure out who they are. So they've internalized a sense of low self-worth, of deviance, of something that's bad about themselves before they even know what the language is. So the use of language in the home is incredibly important. It's important for everybody, regardless of how these children turn out, because when children learn respectful language in the home, they're going to be more respectful in school and in community organizations and in, you know, any interaction with other children. I think the children who are bullies, who are, you know, harassing and abusing gay kids because they think they're a sissy or call them a fag, as we heard in this film, they've learned that in the home. That's the kind of behavior that's being shown by example. There was a Chinese dad who was monolingual Chinese, had about a 4th grade education, was a day laborer. He said, all of the Chinese newspapers should have this information. I never knew this. I never knew this before I knew that my son was gay, and we need to know how to help our children before we know who they are. So I think that's one answer about creating a safe, supportive environment before the family knows who their children will become. I think another one is for gay issues. So many people think that being gay is all about sex. It's all about social, emotional, spiritual connections. It's part of a deep, sexuality is a part of a deep person's core, but it's also an identity. So it's really much more than that. If you have a child who's being harassed and bullied in school because that child is gender nonconforming, and by the way, there are plenty of kids who are gender nonconforming who don't grow up to be gay, but in the research that's been done, those children who are perceived by other kids to be gay or adults to be gay and abused because of that are at just as high risk for gay kids because it's about such a core aspect of their being. So if you, a very important thing to ask young people is, you know, what are your experiences like in school? You know, what happens to you? And create a place where your child knows that they can talk with you about anything. Those are the kids who are much more likely. We had children in our study, that little boy at age 7, or others at 5, 7, 9, who actually went to their parents and said, I like boys, or I like girls, or, you know, Mom, I think I'm gay. And that began to create a space for the dialogue. So that's how I would answer that question.
There's another comment that came up in our Wednesday session that I think is relevant here. There was a man in that session who's active in his LDS ward and is gay, and said he had been watching a boy from the age of 10, and he just feels certain now that this boy is gay, based on what he'd observed. So he went to the father of this boy. He said, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. So I decided I was going to say something, even if it was wrong. So he said to this dad, what are you doing about your son? And the dad said, what do you mean? What are we doing about our son? He said, well, I think he's gay. And the dad said, oh, well, my wife and I have talked about that, but we don't know who to talk to. We don't know what to do about it. This is an LDS warning. He said, I'm so glad you talked to me because we didn't know where to go. And I think we've got that kind of situation all over for all of these teenagers who are trying to deal with this by themselves, and their parents don't know what to do about it when they see it. So Caitlin has the answer.
There's some answers.
And I would say, as a grandfather, if I had a grandson doing that, I would just watch him and not I'd let him grow and experiment and do, be prepared to do whatever he needed to do for me to nurture him. I'd like to apologize for doing something that I don't really approve of, which is being really dogmatic about these people who are insisting that they can change homosexuality. I'm not a scientist. I know that the research, which is often used by these people to support their thesis from scientists whom I do respect, is highly questionable. And to me, to reinforce this idea means that every parent within an LDS community who encounters this will try, is more likely to try to change that child if in fact that's what they're being told can happen. And I personally have seen the destructive evidence of that. So just a couple of remarks. What the new APA statement recommends for therapists working with homosexuals can be instructive for all of us. It recommends that we find a way to communicate, quote, unconditional positive regard for and congruence and empathy while making the environment, quote, a place of compassionate caring and respect that facilitates development, and also to reduce distress caused by isolation, stigma, and shame. If Latter-day Saints could just fully accept modern scientific conclusion that homosexuality is, quote, a normal variant of human sexuality, or as gender variant or gender nonconforming, and not continue to regard it as a disorder. And if we could regard homosexuals as fully human and treat them as Christ calls us to treat them, that is, according to the golden rule, as we ourselves would want to be treated, then we would make a quantum leap in regard to love and faith. Yes, it begins with a family, but as Caitlin has said, it also ends with a family. As I have said before, all of us, and this includes both us as individuals, as congregation, and as the institutional church, we all stand condemned before the 25th chapter of Matthew. There, Christ places himself in the mind, body, and soul of those we consider the least. He challenges the very marrow of our religiosity by saying that if we have withheld water, food, or shelter, which are also metaphors as well for justice, compassion, and love, from those we consider least among us, then we have withheld these same things from Christ. In his commentary on Matthew, Francisco Goldman says, the great metaphor at the heart of the gospel according to St. Matthew is that those who suffer and those who show suffering for those who do suffer
are joined through suffering and grace to Jesus Christ. It is my sincere prayer that as parents, as families, as friends, and as congregations, and as a church, we may be so joined to our great suffering servant, our merciful Lord and Savior. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bob and Caitlin. I'd just like to use the chair's prerogative and invite Caitlin to explain what she said to that parents of a 13-year-old might say to him. And I remember your responding, and you said, you just talk to that child and make them feel open to talk about it.
Yeah,
and I can't remember exactly.
Well, that's you saying.
Yeah, that's basically what she said. So I think we should feel free to sort of make things open and let them feel free to talk about it.
I think the booklet really says it very well, because what you're going to find in that booklet that we've made available for you, and by the way, we're creating other versions of this, including a version for LDS families. It gives you some language that came from parents themselves, and I don't think anybody can say it better than that. And I know you've had a long day, and I don't want to keep you any longer. I really appreciate you coming. Thank you very much.